times when you look at things like Confucius and some of those Eastern philosophers and stuff like that. There's so much that is happening now.
There we go. We got the intro. That's the 33-second version.
3-second version.
We're here.
Yeah, we're here, and it's Thursday. It's beautiful out. Welcome to another episode of the Joe and Doug Show. How's Joe today?
Good.
Good. You go tomorrow on Gus.
Tomorrow morning, yeah.
Are you excited?
Oh, so excited.
Is your bag packed? Like you're just...
Oh, yeah. Like every day this week, I was sitting in Gus saying, what can I do now? We can speed this up. We can speed this up.
Now, what do you have to do to prep to get him ready? Because I know it's been a while, but
this
guys
is the first time out since we had it away for the winter. So we have to bring like the food stuffs, and usually it's packed and we could just go in a moment's notice, but we got to like refill all that stuff now.
Gotcha.
But I'll tell you, like, when I look through some of the crap that we've accumulated, even in Gus, like I am not surprised that people turn into hoarders. I really am not.
We just started doing some spring cleaning in our basement. We cleaned out one of the crawl spaces, and like we had like the changing table from when like Charlotte was a baby, and like stuff that we stuck in there. Like, oh, we'll probably use this again. And my wife is always willing. I'm like, I mean, we might use it again. And but I've done pretty good. We threw out a bunch of stuff and set some stuff aside that we want to. Like, we have a little Mickey Mouse card table that the kids use that they're all too big to sit at. And I'm like, all right, we have to pass this on to somebody else. Like, it's stupid for it to sit there and collect dust. So like somebody can use a Mickey Mouse card table. So like we have some stuff that is in decent shape that we'll pass on, and then other stuff that we're like, why did we keep this?
Yeah. Well, in the metaverse, what I'm going to have happen is that when I accumulate stuff in the virtual world, I'm going to have a count of them. If I haven't used it in a year, it'll auto sell. Right. Oh, nice.
Hey, metaverse.
The metaverse.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, one of the neat parts of spring and coming into, you know, that season is everybody gets full of new life and they want to, you know, their spring cleaning. I did some yard work. You get stuff just that's been sitting there and, you know, not in the right place. It's not, you know, all winter you kind of neglected it. Now it's time to clean it again or to get it in the right spot. I don't know why that is. Like, all my neighbors have been out like cutting the grass already in like little beautiful triangles and getting, you know, I'm like, wow, their yard looks really good. I'm like, I guess I better get mine fertilized. You know, like some of it's like, you know, all right, I don't care. But then some of it's also like, oh yeah, I don't know. You just have that inside, you see the, you know, the daffodils coming up and you're like, oh, like, you know, this is a new season. Yep. How does Joe respond to new? Does he just keep doing what he's doing, or are there certain things that you do coming into a new season?
So, you know, I take my cues from those new things, because I honestly, we try so hard to keep our rituals happening so that we're always on point, like we're always average to a certain point, but life kind of goes like this, right? Mm-hmm. And so those cues are like, if you've been in a funk or you think you've been stuck or whatever, those like normal transitions into either consolidation or expansion, I'll look at it and say, okay, well, here's my time. If I'm going to like jump off this horse and grab it, this is the time to do it.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because you talk about those rituals and those routines. They oftentimes bring people comfort. You know, as you step into new, that's my wife's word for the year is new. And she's trying some new things and she's stepping out into some new things. And there have been some new opportunities that have come her way. And I'm kind of like, oh, this is kind of cool. But in that, as she steps into new for her, like we watched a movie last night that we've watched hundreds of times. And, you know, we're watching a show that we could have watched a new episode. And she's like, I've done enough new. I need something comforting,
right?
And I'm going to watch that again. And I'm like, okay, I kind of get that. That makes sense to me. Do you find for yourself the attachment to the ritual and the routine or those things that bring you comfort as you step into the new, you kind of have to tether them together or no?
Sort of like, so I subscribe to this. If you ever heard of when Spotify first came out, right? Mm-hmm. Spotify was basically intended to take new music and to be able to give it to people, to give them first doses of something that's coming out. Totally rejected, right? It was a totally rejected premise because it was none of it was actually familiar. Everything was so new. Nobody wanted to listen to music they didn't know.
Interesting.
But there was a bug that got put in one of the system that would sandwich a familiar song, a popular song, in with a new song, and acceptance went through the roof. So all you needed is a good balance between what was familiar and what was new, and it would be accepted.
Now, my brain goes to like five different things as you say that, because that makes a ton of sense to me, because as you implement changes in business, life, church. I know in church, the big thing is like anytime you tweak anything or change anything, there's usually it's very much an upcurrent kind of deal. But from what I'm hearing, the Spotify model is, hey, if I take that new thing and I couple it with something that's familiar from the past, it's going to work. And this is what they do in a lot of songs. So you have songs like Amazing Grace, or you have songs like How Great Thou Art that are, you know, traditional songs that my grandparents would have sung kind of deal, you know, more current in the, you know, early 1900s kind of deal. And now you have people that are remaking them and attaching their tags or their new song with the old. And so that's kind of the Spotify model is what you're saying.
Yeah. So it has to be familiar, like a portion has to be familiar, but you get bored with familiar,
right?
You check out. So there has to be some sexiness of something being new, but they're absolutely related. Not one's not a villain and one's not the hero. They're both needed. Mm. There was a marketing designer, and I can't think of the letters, but it was like most familiar yet new or something like that. But they designed all of the 50s advertising and art. Like if you look at things when they were developed, a lot of like new came out of that era.
Oh, yeah.
Cars had different designs, fashion had new designs, but again, it would be rejected. So they had to implement that most familiar, but also
when you mentioned fashion or car designs, like you even see that they'll tip their hat to bell bottoms or whatever, and then they'll have a quote unquote new version of it, and they'll run these parallel lines that, oh yeah, that's kind of familiar, and I've seen those,
but it's new. But it's new. Yep. Nothing, human beings, like
nothing new under the sun, Joe.
That's exactly right. So when it's presented to you, you kind of know what's happening, but if they tell you that's what they're doing, it spoils the whole thing.
All right, so I'm going to use this happened to me a couple days ago. So I've been following on Instagram some crypto influencers, some you know, millionaire mentors, some health mentors, like that sort of genre of people. And I started following some new ones that I've just found interesting. There's one doctor in particular that his specialty, his program is, we want to help dads who are busy with their career, kids, get healthy. And so like, that's all of his content. And it's very practical, because a lot of times, I don't know, when you look at the Instagram health influencers, it's like, you know, they're ripped with like 97 abdominal muscles and everything else. And like most people look at that and they go, oh, that's inspiring, but I'm never going to be that. And this guy's like, hey, I took this guy who's 325 pounds and I helped him be like 280 pounds. And I'm like, he kind of looks like me. You know, you look at it and you connect, and it's like, oh, and all he did was this. Well, that's kind of practical and that makes sense to me. So, so the number of those, and then some of the crypto stuff, because I'm trying to learn. But one of the things that I found really interesting, I followed about 20 or so new people about 2 or 3 days ago, just people that they kept coming up. People kept sharing their stuff. So I said, oh, I'm just going to give them a follow and see what happens. Well, instantly, like within minutes of following, you got a, hey, thanks so much for following my content. If I can ever help you in any way, hit me up. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. Especially when you're like, man, they have tens of thousands of followers. Obviously that's somebody on their staff or a generated thing, but it felt personal. It was from, it was certainly lead marketing, if that makes sense. You know, in the past, when somebody moved in the neighborhood, you wanted to be in that packet that got delivered to their house. Well, this is essentially, hey, they've moved into my online neighborhood and you started following me. Welcome. And so welcome. And, but I was impressed with a couple of them. Not that I was planning on purchasing anything they had. I was just enjoying the free content, but almost immediately they're like, you know, how can we serve you? They wanted to get to know your story. Like it was very, I knew they were marketing to me, but it didn't feel like they were marketing to me. And it very much coupled, like, I know the close is going to come at some point, the coupled, like the old style marketing, like, hey, $14.99, you can do our program or whatever. But the intro to it was like, these guys are my friends. Like they did a really great job on the front end. And I was kind of, and obviously I'm sure they have, you know, demographic things, and I'm sure they know exactly what words to plug in and all of that. And it's probably very scripted, but in that script, it didn't feel scripted. I don't know how you do that, but it was unscripted scripted. For sure. And so I was just very impressed with, I haven't been marketed to that way online just yet. I've gotten, you know, email stuff for forever, but this was the first time I was getting blasted from like Instagram. And it was like, I followed 20 and I think 4 of them all followed up in very similar fashions. And I'm going, okay, this is marketing, but it's like, oh, I've made a connection here. This is kind of cool. And most of them were not, none of them were like, I got to make a sale. They were all like, well, how can we help? Oh, you should check out my content over here. I'll tag you in that video or whatever. And I'm like, oh, that's really neat. You know, especially the crypto guys are like, oh, if you're just buying and holding, good luck, watch our content. You know, if you're ever interested in trading, we have a program for that. But if not, you know, hope to see a, like a video or two. Like, so it was very non-committal committal. But I just liked it because it was like, oh, this is just the updated version of advertising marketing that, you know, 30 years ago, you'd have to buy a commercial on TV or wherever. And they're just doing it one-on-one. This is cold calls, you know, telemarketers, if you will, you know, online, which I knew I was being marketed to, but it didn't feel like, I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, that'll change too, because that will only be as long as it's effective. And as soon as too many people do it, not effective anymore. And it goes to something else. So I become this really big target for incoming marketing. So I get to see all of the different strategies, and I see people using super aggressive, like bullying strategies. And I see people using very passive, like what you're recommending and, or what you experience. And like, I look at it and say, if I were a buyer, which one would make me do anything? And it's literally whatever is keeping, whatever least amount of people are freaking doing. So if they're, if I want some guy just to tell me truth and be mean about it, because I'm so sick of all the dressing,
people take you
through all these loops of it takes 20 minutes to get to the pitch.
Yep.
I'm like, just get it over with, you know?
Just give it to me.
Yes, right.
Yeah. No, I tend to be more relational. So I like the back and forth and being able to share a little of my context. That for me creates value. And I'm sure they know that. But on the other end, when it comes to the pitch, like I understand we've built a context, right? Like, so the one account I went back and forth, I don't know, maybe a dozen or so comments. And they were like, well, you know, we could probably really help you in this area. And one of the things that I liked about it is they weren't trying to be like, well, now that we're best friends, you know, they were just like, here's the bottom line. This is what we do. This is what it costs. You can continue to consume the free content. Send me a message every once in a while and I'll help you out. But if you want to do our program, this is what we do. And I love that it was like, no bull crap. It was just, here it is.
But eventually it will be bull crap. Because I said, I like that this is the era that we're in, but it's just coincidence that we're in this era. So for instance, when I first started, we took a couple of sales program workshops. And you know, one of the, you know, as far as, especially when it's like contract driven work, there's a 60% chance that if someone's holding a pen, they'll sign a contract. So salespeople would do things like this. Hey, I got this really cool pen. If I can get you to catch it and hold it, 60% chance you're going to sign my contract.
Really?
So you saw the slimiest people knowing this and you not knowing this, try to get a pen in your hand. Right. Huh. And even today, you'll see an old school salesperson be like, hey, why don't you keep that pen? That's what they're trying to do. So as soon as they know the psychology, but what makes people do things,
dirty.
They enact on it. It's slimy, man. Yeah. I've never done it, but since I saw what trained salespeople do, then you know it, you know?
Yeah, well, I know there's whole books on body language and all of that. And there's nothing. I don't think there's anything wrong with knowing as much as you can, but it's when you're knowing that stuff in order to take advantage of the person in front of you is different. I always think that people can tell when you're actually genuinely interested in serving them or you're just interested in convincing them to serve you. And I feel like 80% of sales and stuff, like when I've gone in to buy cars in the past, or recently I've done leases, but when I've gone in to buy cars in the past, you know, the salesperson, sometimes I'm like, you know, I'm not here for you, right? like you're here for me, right? And this is what I need to do. But if they're not good at it, they'll get into a spot where you're just like, all right, I really don't want to buy from you because I'm not here to make this. You know, they'll start telling you, well, you know, we had a new salesperson, I don't know, a while ago, and they said, you know, she said to us, I've only sold a couple of cars this month, and I'm like, I don't care. Like, I'm not here to add another car to your quota, and I get it. She was nervous and probably was filling space to talk. And I'm a softie and love people. And so being, you know, nice and generous, and we kind of had already picked the car out anyway. So she didn't have to necessarily sell us. But in that sense, I'm like, everything that she talked about was about her. And I was kind of like, I'm not here for you. Like, you're here for me. Like, you should be getting to know me and getting to, oh, well, you know what? This would be a better advantage for you. And we could do this and we could throw this in that to help you understand me. And I feel like in sales, though, and in business in general, people know when you're genuinely there to serve them. It's like when somebody comes in to have their computer fixed at Youngstown Computer, and you're like, you know what? You can get your computer fixed here, but it's probably going to be more expensive. We're going to do a good job. But if you went over there, like, this is what they do, and they would be able to help you and service you at a better, and they're looking at you like, why are you sending my – I mean, you can pay for it here, but I'm going to be upfront with you that there's a cheaper way to go. And, like, that's their brand cup of tea.
Most of marketing is just qualifying, making sure you line somebody up with something they really need and that they're a good customer for you. And, you know, breaking up with people, firing them for being in the wrong place is part of the sales process.
Yeah. Well, and we do, I do this quite frequently at church, and sometimes, especially in the beginning, it would take some of the staff and some of the team, like, why are you doing that? And I'm like, we had a lady, her family came out of the Mormon church. Now, regardless of theological differences, she had come out of that, and it was much more traditional than what we were used to. But she had a connection, came to our church for a little bit, and I could tell, like, she just needed something more traditional. She needed a hymn book. She needed something like that. And we had a couple of conversations, and I said, you know, you might want to try a Methodist church. You might want to try. And to my knowledge, I think she landed at a Methodist church. But, like, yeah, I could have tried to convince her that our model was the best, but what her family needed was that step in that space. And so it's better for me to serve her, because then she's going to run into somebody at the Methodist church that's like, man, I really need something more contemporary. She's going to go, there's a great church. It wasn't really our cup of tea, but you would probably love it. And not that I sent her there so that she'd do that, but that's how the reciprocation happens.
Yeah, on and the those back seeds end. That we talked about the other day, like, you never know what you're going to get out of that, but you plant it anyway.
Yep. And if you always seek to serve the person in front of you's best interest, it always returns to you tenfold, a hundredfold.
And think about it this way. If you had a model that was straight up, where you just told the truth and you just tried to play it straight, and the rest of the world was opposite of that, you're actually higher valued, and you do better in a market that's worse, right? If too many people were honest, there would be no value in being honest.
Yeah,
Everybody would, you go, the guy next door is just as honest as you.
You know, it's funny. I was just listening to Joe Rogan's podcast, which I love Joe Rogan. You know, I don't agree with everything Joe Rogan says. I don't agree with every guest that's on there. But what I love about him is he's intellectually honest. Yep. He's not a hypocrite. He's going to tell you when he disagrees with something, when he agrees with something, and he asks great questions. And I love the long form kind of format interview. Well, he just had Bill Maher on, who Bill Maher and I, from a philosophical level, are diametrically on opposite ends. Yep. But Bill Maher keeps finding himself in camps that he would have never found himself 20 years ago, 30 years ago, because he's intellectually honest. And so he's finding himself and going, well, you know, I'm a liberal. I'm on the left. I see things a certain way, but the people over here are, you know, being intellectually dishonest. I mean, he's called the, just as much as he calls the right out on their hypocrisy, he's started to do it to the left a whole bunch. And it's put him in this weird spot where he's hanging out with Ben Shapiro and he's hanging out with these other people. And him and Rogan talked about that. And they said exactly what you said. They said essentially what makes them stand out in this culture is they're just being intellectually honest and nobody else is.
Right.
And I love that. I think it's so true. And people are craving that. That's what they really want.
And it's hard for someone to be objective about the things they believe in, because if the market turns on you and says they'd stop believing this and you got to go contra that. Like, think of a liberal that just had to stay where they were at, how much opposed they would be with other people that used to be standing right next to them.
For instance,
yes,
intellectual dishonesty,
mm-hmm.
right? So Hollywood, that's all I have to say.
That's it.
We can wrap up the show. During the Oscars, they came out and you had all sorts of political commentary on Florida's Don't Say Gay bill. Essentially, kindergarten through third grade can't groom our kids and talk to them about sexuality. Actually, nowhere in the bill did it say anything about gay or whatever. So they came out and there were a couple of comedians that opened the show and they said gay or whatever. And the Babylon Bee actually had a really funny post of Joe Biden saying, passing the Don't Say Gas bill. It was really funny. But so they had this whole thing about Don't Say Gay bill. And the new Harry Potter movie's coming out with Dumbledore's background or whatever it's called, like The Secrets of Dumbledore. And in the film, it is alluded to, both indirectly and directly, that Dumbledore had a same-sex relationship, and so there's this gay element to it. Now, here's where the hypocrisy comes in. In China, to run that film, they had them remove and edit references to the same-sex relationship so they could run in China, and Disney was like, no problem.
Mm.
Like, you're doing all of this. You got the whole, you know, Disney all up in arms in Florida. You know, we're for the LGBTQ plus IA question mark, whatever view. And at the end of the day, you have this, you know, agenda on the other side where they're saying, yeah, but, you know, if it's going to cost us money, we'll take it out.
Yeah.
And that's so, and in America, you know, nobody's going to hear that because it's happening over in China. But they literally edited the gay out of the movie so that it could play in China and they could make money.
Wow. Let me give you a Bill Maher so contradiction, because I listened to that episode as well.
Okay, really, yeah, it was great.
And, but I thought about this for hours after I listened to it, because it was the I wish that when people were blatantly contradicting themselves that they would realize it, and they never do.
Well, and that's the whole thing. Like, all right, Hollywood, like, if that's your stance, just be consistent,
right?
Run it in China the way that you run it here, and stand by your principles. But the problem is it has zero to do with principles.
So he was talking about environmentalism and global warming in the first portion of it, and they were arguing back and forth that it's, you know, accepted science and it's not a religion and blah blah blah, right? Okay, I mean, if you believe in that, then that's your thing, and I don't care how, you know, entrenched you are in it. It's what you are. But then, like, the next conversation was about drugs and whatever, and he was like, well, we don't believe them because we have to, you know, push back on what we're being told. What if they're lying? And I'm like, what about the other one? Same philosophy. Okay, if you believe it, then it's true, but what if not? What if they're totally lying and they're fabricating it and they have a vested interest in an outcome? And whatever. All the things you just said about drug companies could totally apply to that other one.
Yeah. No, I caught that too, because he's very much climate change for Bill Maher is a very big issue. He talked about it on Shapiro's Sunday special with him. I find him, you know, fascinating in the sense that, you know, he's pretty principled as a liberal, and yet he still tends to side on the left, which drives me a little bananas, because I'm like, you know, I don't see the principles in the same way.
How much do you think that's shticked, though? Like, that he just decides that if he's not going to get enough action from who he opposes, that he takes on some friendlies?
I don't know. Realistically, though, like, I mean, he has a track record. Like, you can go back and watch. I feel like he's been fairly consistent with free speech, fairly consistent with climate change. Like, you know, all of that stuff, agree or disagree with him. I think you can go back 25 years and see.
Well, there are some, like, I followed him when he was on HBO, and there are some episodes that didn't get me all feeling like he was this consistent person. He was completely partisan through that era. So he's had some eras where he wasn't this version.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah. And he could have grown too. The other side of it. But yeah, he certainly is emerging as a, you know, an intellectually, you know, honest broker that people look at on the left anyway and go, oh, you know what? I guess.
I'll tell you, though, I garner more information from people I disagree with every 100%.
Well, I think we were talking about this the other day. You're saying that with your example with Twitter, having people have, you know, their own camp and then, you know, having a no holds bar kind of area. And that's where all the fun happens. Absolutely. Like, I love getting together with people that I think differently, that push me, that think I'm crazy when it comes to X or Y. Like, you know, as long as we're not an ad hominem and we're talking about solutions, like, I'll entertain those conversations all day long. They were the best when I was in college. Like, I can remember going to class for 2 or 3 hours, and then we would at night class, and then we would go to Applebee's afterwards and sit and argue for 2 hours about what we just had a 3-hour lecture on. But we were all passionate about it, and some of us adamantly disagreed with stuff that was presented. And it's how you grow. It's how you sharpen yourself.
Yeah, I'm so not good at arguing in this era, though. I used to be pretty good, because it was kind of, you know, you had you're trying to persuade, you were trying to make your best thing. It was an actual, like, debate type of thing. Mm-hmm. But now it's just like poke holes in each other and, you know, try to injure each other. And it's not even fun anymore. I have people that I super like, I know they're intelligent. I know if they weren't in a public sphere that we could totally talk about this differently. Sure. And they all resort down to those attacks. And
yeah, it's almost like you have to get people in a room. You know, when I have a husband and wife that come to me for counseling, I almost have to define, all right, what's our goal? All right, our goal is we want to go to bed without fighting. Our goal is, all right, that's the goal. And then how do we get there? You guys have diametrically opposed views on how to get there. So we're going to shoot that as the target. And now everything we say and do from this point on isn't about being right, but is about getting to that target. And if you can start getting and you start inching your way towards it, that's a different ball of wax. But in a lot of these debates, it's about scoring points. It's about getting a viral clip. It's about, you know, having your 5 seconds of fame on Instagram or whatever it is so that you can cater to your own crowd and garner the likes and the shares and all of that, which doesn't allow for intellectually honest debate. It's one of the reasons why, honestly, I like the 3 hour long Joe Rogan podcast, because he's not shooting. Now, yeah, they'll splice out sound clips, but that's not what he's shooting for. He's having this 3 hour conversation, and they're going to get into this and that, and they're going to talk a little bit of politics, and they're going to talk about him and Bill Maher got into moose in Alaska. That was really funny.
But they were really high. So they were really high.
I had never watched one of his ones where I know Joe Rogan will smoke pot. And I watched it. I was like, oh, they're smoking a lot of weed on this.
A lot.
And yeah, so that definitely by that point, yeah, when they started talking about moose and stuff, I was like, okay, we're devolving pretty quickly here.
But it was fun to listen to people go down that path and be high doing it. So. Can I switch gears on you?
Yeah, let's do it.
We talked a lot about that, you know, when something's working, it's because we haven't been desensitized to it yet. And, you know, you have really scummy things like the pen drop in your hand that makes you sign a contract. And you have the nice things, the era that we're in right now. The one that concerns me the most, totally different topic here, is how desensitized people are getting to death, like to seeing people dead. Mm. To the idea of people dying, to babies' death. I mean, the whole thing, I get really disturbed when like I see an image that I know that person left us. That hits me. Like, and I think that if you're in a generation that doesn't see anything in that, like that, I have a lot of fear around that.
Yeah. Familiarity with things like that numbs us. It's interesting though, because you know, some people are around it. Like you think of morticians and people in that industry. I mean, that's part of the deal. As a pastor, I'm around it fairly frequently. But I can remember the first few times, like being at a funeral and then knowing like the body's staying overnight in the church, or like being in the building and knowing there was a body in the building. It was like, it skeeved me out the first couple of times. But then you get used to it. You get into a spot where, okay, you know, it's just part of the job, you know, kind of thing. But you know, when it's not something that you're used to, it keeps you in that space where you're kind of like, oh, you know, this is strange. This is whatever. There's a pastor that a friend of mine worked for him, and he was old school. Like, I don't think he ever owned a cell phone, like used to keep a little notepad in his pocket, but knew everybody. He was very good at networking. He would do a lot of funerals. A lot. He'd pastored in the same community 40 some years. This was in Pennsylvania. And right by where I went to Bible school, and he would do tons and tons, and he would get invited to do funerals that nobody had pastor for. So he would do funerals for people he didn't even know in that sense. And he was kind of like the pastor of the town. He'd been there so long, and you know, so many people knew who he was, had come to an Easter service at some point or a Christmas service. And when my buddy started working for him, they sat down at like the first or second staff meeting. And one of the things he did as like just a fun thing is he took lots of pictures. He was like photographer of sorts. And he'd take pictures of trees and birds and flowers and stuff, but he would take pictures of every single person he did a funeral for in their casket. And my friend didn't know this, and they started passing pictures around at staff meetings. So, you know, he liked to show off his work, and, you know, it was like tree, flower, you know, him and his wife. And it was like four people in a casket for the next couple of pictures. And my buddy was like, oh my gosh. And everybody thought, they were all waiting for his reaction, because they knew that that's what pastor did. And and he's like, you know, so he's like, I've seen a lot of pictures of dead people in their caskets, but that was one of the ways for him that he you know, memorialized some of that and processed some of that. But it is interesting when you start desensitizing yourself, especially with the media and the way stuff goes, whether you're talking about the subway shooting in New York or the war in Ukraine, or even propaganda material on the left and the right with all the stuff with COVID, you know, you're killing grandma, and then you got, you know, the right saying, it gets a little overwhelming.
Yeah. And honestly, like if it's slowly, like in the beginning of COVID, you had this rise of deaths. By the time you had like 10,000 deaths a day on it, you almost didn't feel any different than when two deaths happened to
you. Sure.
But if at the peak, if that happened all in one day, you would be like, oh shit, it wasn't connected to something, you know, else, the, you know, the pot boiling with the frog in it kind of a thing.
Well, and numbers, and here's the thing though, that, and the media know this, and this is why it is scummy. They know the psychology behind headlines and the way they present stuff. They know what's going to get clicks. And unfortunately, just like we're talking about with the other stuff, the whole journalism industry is about attention, not about news.
Data, right.
And so you're in a spot where they're not just in the way they're presenting it, but also in the order it's being presented to you, with the colors, with the words. I mean, all of it is broken down to the psychology of Joe, and how are we going to get Joe to watch one more article, click one more link, be in one more spot, hold on for 30 more seconds so that we can make this much more money. And unfortunately, when your whole business model is that, you're going to be very intellectually dishonest in that regard.
Well, you as a consumer of news, let's just say we went the opposite direction and media outlets started just giving you data and they left out the part of how you should feel about it. If you read an article and maybe you weren't in that industry, would you be wondering like how, if you should be mad or not?
All right. So the Daily Wire, and I Daily Wire subscriber, full disclosure, I listen to Ben Shapiro most days. They started a news show that's 10 or 15 minutes of like Walter Cronkite headlines. I think it's called Morning Wire. It's 15 minutes every morning, and it's literally just highlight reel. This happened. Here's the facts. This happened. Here's the facts. There's no commentary to it. It's not painted. It's just Nancy Pelosi signed this bill. They're a little more entertaining than that, but it takes out all of the color commentary. And the whole goal was to just present the facts, that we want to have an honest journalism news presentation where, hey, this is how many people died. This is what happened. And this is that done. It's so boring.
Is it?
I tried. I was like, you know what? That'd be a great way to get my news. 15 minutes. I'll get all the headlines. And then if I can't catch Shapiro later, it is what it is. And I, for like a week or two, I tried. And I was just like, I'd put it on when I went in the shower and in the bathroom, like 15 minutes. I'm about ready in 15 minutes. It's perfect. Put it on. Had my speaker or whatever. And they would just go. And I'd be like,
you tuned out a couple times.
I did. It just became white noise because and probably that's because it's almost like when you're so used to having so much sugar and then you don't, everything tastes bland.
Yes.
And I think that's really the case, is we're so used to being overhyped in the news that when you get something like that, now you're like, what is this garbage?
Now, if they do the Spotify thing where they threw some news that were good to listen to, sandwiched between some facts, might make it palatable.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that might be a better
metaphor. And that's the thing, like these sensitized, desensitized moments, like we, you know, consumers really tell these manufacturers, like, we are responsible for how the news is presented, because if you watch, then it's good. And if you don't watch, it's bad, and it'll change.
Yeah. And where we spend our dollars and where we spend our attention tells them what they're going to produce. And so to some extent, you can't be upset with Hollywood. Yes, you can call them out for their hypocrisy, and you can call them out for saying one thing in this country and doing another thing in another country. I think that's all fair. But to some extent, like, we can't blame them for producing what they're producing, because we're spending money on it. We're giving it time, attention. We're downloading their subscriptions. We're ordering their movies. And I'm not an advocate for them not being able to produce whatever they want to produce. It's not cancel culture in that regard. But we should be choosing better.
So back to the Rogan deal.
Yeah.
So we like what he's saying, because he's a guy that's not afraid to say that he was wrong. He
gives
the truth. So how is it that Rogan isn't the boring Cronkite type of news reading? What makes him willing to listen to it, knowing that it's long form? Because you put anybody other than Rogan in that seat, right? And you're probably not listening. So what about him makes
that's
you listen?
That's a great question. I mean, he's the Fear Factor guy. I mean,
you're thinking he might UFC. Eat something gross in the middle of.
No, I think he has a personal brand and has some credibility in that regard. I think he's been doing it for a while, chipping away. It's not like a overnight success. Like, he's garnered an audience. I think the long format interviews help when the person's exciting. Like, I don't watch all of his shows. I watched Bill Maher because I happen to think Bill Maher's interesting. I watched when he had Shapiro on. I happen to think Ben Shapiro's interesting. And I watched when he had a couple of the doctors that nobody would let on any other station, because it was interesting. I was like, I may not agree with everything that they say, but man, these guys are being blacklisted from all these other sites, and he's going to interview them. sure, I want to sit there for 3 hours and listen to that. I don't necessarily watch it because Joe Rogan's interesting. I think that he's honest and the guests he has on are interesting.
Well, the honesty part would spoil it like the Cronkite, where a lot of people would say, oh, I can get this news and facts. But what I think he does is because he's a little bit crazy in some respects, and he will take some of his craziness and bookend it on things that are not crazy. So a serious topic surrounded by UFOs and, and you know, whatever.
And ghosts that is, and whatever. Yeah,
exactly. That's the ticket. And he'll just say something crazy in the middle of a pursuit, a really big intellectual pursuit. Like, hey, do you believe in the Loch Ness Monster? Right. And just a tangle with the.
Well, he said that in the Maher interview with Bill Maher, he said that when somebody starts going down one of these things that he's like, man, that's really out there, I'll just ask him, like, do you believe in ghosts or whatever? Like,
yes.
You know, just because they're already, you know, out on a limb, maybe they'll go out further.
But it's like you and I sitting down at a table, I'd be thinking of smart ass remarks to throw at you. And that's exactly what he does.
Yeah.
Right. In a normal interview, you get the View people sitting down for a 3 hour long form. I'd blow my brains out. Right.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, and I think some of it, though, you know, goes back to like Rogan has branded himself like he's not there to push an agenda. He's there to push the truth. And so because he's branded himself that way and he's stood up to cancel culture when he was tried to be canceled, and he's done stuff to stay intellectually honest. He apologizes when he makes wrong statements or whatever, or when he gets new information and lets us know. So, you know, you look at somebody like that, and when they brand themselves that way and they position themselves not just as an arbiter of truth, but as somebody who wants to discover it themselves, you almost feel like you're joining him in the pursuit of truth, which I think is a powerful tool. It's not, I'm not coming to him to get the information. We're going to learn it together.
That's right.
And so it almost creates a partnership as you watch the episode.
And he doesn't come to you as he's the authority on it.
Right.
He lets the content be
exactly.
The yep.
That's the expert sitting in front of him.
Yep.
You know, and that's what I think, I feel like most people are looking for that. If you're looking for your partisan thing, you know where to click.
There's a ton of it,
right?
Out there.
That's easy. It's easy to get, but to get somebody, and even, you know, Shapiro is openly partisan. He's like, this is the largest, fastest growing conservative podcast in the nation. I mean, that is his tag in every show. He's not hiding the ball. Like, he's like, this has a conservative slant. This is my views. It's an opinion show. And for me, when you come out of the gate and say that, it's intellectually honest at that point. You may not like his conservative views, but he's not telling you I'm brokering this. I'm an honest broker. He's saying, hey, I have a certain worldview and I'm going to paint with that color
so
brush.
When you listen to a Ben Shapiro show, are you getting like, what are you getting out of it? Are you getting just a acknowledgement of what you'd believe to be true and you're hearing another person?
I think there's some of that. I share a Judeo-Christian worldview. And so I love some of, you know, he'll interject scripture at times into things, and I'm like, oh man, that's really, really good that you know, that sort of lens with it. I happen to, you know, tend to agree with a lot of his presuppositions and positions. So for me, it helps me see the news and then get it through my worldview and my lens. But I also know that, like, hey, on the other side of Ben Shapiro is this, and the truth is probably
pick your biggest other side person that you think.
Anybody on MSNBC or CNN.
Trevor Noah. Could you go over to the Trevor Noah show?
Oh, I've watched the Trevor Noah show, yeah.
And not get blood pressure up.
No, yeah. Well, the whole thing, though, so like the reason CNN's app flops and the reason CNN's ratings tank, aside from just blatantly lying to viewers, they're intellectually dishonest. Like, if they came out and said, we're the largest, fastest growing leftist news organization out there, okay,
right.
You would pick up viewers. People wouldn't be able to slam you, wouldn't be able to say, but when you're like, we're the honest brokers of news, it's like, shove it, dude. Like, we know that you have an agenda. We know who's paying your bills. We know who the whole staff contributed to in the last election. So just be honest about it. Say, hey, you know what? We're CNN. We're the largest, fastest growing progressive, you know, podcast. And they, okay, I can tolerate that because it's intellectually honest at that point. I don't have to like what they say, but I know what's going to come out of their mouth. And so, you know, when it's almost like when the kid on the playground is like, well, I'm the best football player here or whatever, or I'll beat you and whatever. And then you get on the field and you're like, dude, you suck. And, well, you know, I haven't played in a long time. Right. And then the excuses come. It's like, well, no, you lied to us. You led us on and we picked you second, you know? So I think that is the biggest issue facing the media. If there was just intellectual honesty. And I think probably the same thing's true in Congress. Like if people just wore, there's that meme from years ago with the congressperson in their suit jacket and they had patches of all the companies that sponsored them and lobbied them. Like
you would know why they,
right. Like, all right, I get it. You're beholden to the oil lobby. Like, you know, don't pretend that you're not. Right. All right. You're beholden to the climate lobby. Like, don't pretend that you're not. That's fine. Like we know where, you know, stuff's going to break down in this. So, you know, some of it is the more that gets revealed, the more pissed off I think people get, because it's like, it's frustrating because you want to believe that there are good, honest, authentic people out there. But the more and more you look, you find, all right, it's Joe Rogan and Bill Maher, and not to be whatever, I don't agree with everything that they say. They're getting high on the air together. So it's not exactly the pinnacle of morality.
So you're not going to talk to your friend and say, hey, watch this place where you see two doofuses right. get high, right?
It's not the pinnacle of morality by any means, but it's such slim pickings where if you go back 40 or 50 years, the goal of intellectual honesty and being authentic and clear and concise with stuff like that. And we had a similar vocabulary and we had a similar, you know, there's so much that the red states get redder, the blue states get bluer. And, you know, you watch the disintegration into tribalism is right. essentially where
now,
we're
I rolled my eyes at you and I want to explain the eye yeah. roll real quick. Because what I really hate, another sense desensitization that we've gotten is that, the word lie and liar, like,
yeah,
if you're an impartial person just standing around, everybody is calling everyone else a liar now
all the time.
From a math standpoint, not everybody can be a liar, right? Sure. Somebody has to be telling the truth in here. But if you ask one dude, they're like, my news station tells the truth, theirs lies,
right.
And the other person says the exact same thing,
right?
Now I kind of need, because of seeking truth like I am, I need to at least have some kind of metric to be able to know what this is. And I don't have time to go around and fact check everyone
yep.
and fact check the fact checkers. I just give up. Like, as soon as people start throwing, you're a liar and you're a racist, those are two things that are meaningless now yeah. because we're completely desensitized.
So there's two things. One's a scripture.
I did it.
You know, the Bible says that when Satan speaks, he's the father of lies. And when he lies, he speaks his native language. And when you hear all of this dishonesty and lying and stuff like that, like it positions you in the wrong camp. On the other side, you know, the intellectual dishonesty is used to create confusion so that people will agree with principles they wouldn't normally agree with. And you see that, you see it on both sides. Right. So you'll see an intellectual dishonesty on the right when we soften what we say about social issues. We really believe over here, but we're going to soften this so that we're more palatable to people in the middle. Because, you know, if we say we don't believe that anyone should ever have an abortion ever, you know, these people in the middle are never going to vote for us. So we have to soften our position for that. And you see that on both sides, right? And so what ends up happening is they can lob those across because they are being intellectually dishonest.
Effective
because
too.
Right. And the principle that we stand on, if everybody came out and said, you know, here's the principle that we stand on, it'd be so much easier to go, well, I agree with that or I don't agree with
well,
that.
Well, let's use the pen. Okay. So yeah. as soon as you know, like if you just handed someone a pen, not knowing the statistics on what makes them sign a contract,
right?
Then you're just handing somebody a pen. But as soon as you know the information that controls an outcome, it's ineffective,
right?
Then you drop the pen on everybody. Now it's a little dirtier because
yeah.
you're doing it as a manipulation on purpose.
Right. And that's where the line comes in, is you're manipulating me. You're telling me what I need to hear to agree with you and get your vote, not what you actually believe.
Right. And the headline, yeah. if I know you'll read the article, if I say something in there that's, you know, fringe, not true,
exactly.
it's the same thing as the pen.
And it comes back, it's the bait and switch. It comes back to the marketing and everything else. Like, you know, the politician being your friend to get your vote is the same thing as the marketer asking you about your kids so that they could sell you a product. Both are dirty. And at the end of the day, like if you're going to be genuinely interested, great. If not, state your principles and stay out of my life. You know, that's just me. But for the vast majority, the reason they can lob those across is because they will compromise their actual principle in order to what they think is shift people over to their position. It's one of the things, like them or hate them, Donald Trump would say some of the most outlandish stuff. And principle wise, people are like, I agree with you on principle, but then you keep opening your mouth and now I can't defend you. So it became impossible for people to be like, well, yeah, I know what he's doing in law. I know what he's doing over here. I know what he's doing in principle, but he keeps opening his mouth and he discredits himself. And then it puts supporters in a spot where they're like, well, I can't support him because I can't defend that. He said something totally crazy. And so that became really, really difficult. And the intellectual honesty of a Joe Rogan, or, you know, being able to broker that, requires him to go, here's my principle. Like, this is what I think about that. And then just stand on it and not move because the crowd moves or because he gets, well, I'm going to pull advertisement or whatever, and going, oh, well, this is who we are. And if you don't like that, you know, tough cookies.
So here's the third reel of Joe Rogan. Then we've cited him many times here. So first, he runs a true campaign over there. Number two is that there's an entertainment value and he breaks up the, you know, not whatever, or the stuff that's hard to listen to when it comes to data or facts or whatever. And then the third role is that when he gets someone that counters him, he doesn't change where he is. So he's not doing it for the effect. Like if he, okay, so he would find out that the pen wasn't effect and he'd still do it because it's his brand. And no matter what the effect, that's him.
Exactly. So
that's the third rail: authenticity, and entertainment.
Yep. Totally agree. So if you're doing a podcast or you're trying to sell a product or you're running for office, just be consistent. I mean, I think that's the truest thing. My grandmother said, I asked my grandmother, she raised 8 awesome kids and they all are married and have wonderful families of their own. They've been, you know, successful and good citizens, all of that sort of stuff. And I said to my grandma when we had Charlotte, I was like, what's the key to being a good parent? And she was like, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Be consistent. And I think that's true across the board in life. People will trust you more if you're consistent.
There you go.
Boom.
Boom.
Thank you for listening to this show on Youngstown Studio. If you like our programming, we invite you to subscribe to our YouTube channel, follow our Facebook page, or subscribe to your favorite podcast platform like iTunes or Spotify. This is original Youngstown content, and we would appreciate you sharing the videos and the word about it.